Hello, and welcome to I Want What She Has, a show that amplifies women's voices and their stories. I'm your host, Teresa Widman, and I'm excited to be back to do a full show. This is like the first time that we're really doing a full show with me at home, Ida womaning the board back at the station. And I was really, I feel fortunate to be introduced to the two women who are my guests today. Rebecca Horner and Karen Pardini are two members of the Marbletown First Aid Unit, which may be obvious to some folks, but just to explain, it's basically the EMS services for a region here in the Ulster County. And it was something that I never really thought much about. I actually lived right next to one of the firehouses, which is often one of the units that gets called out to do EMS services. And I never really understood all the dynamics of how this system operates. And so I'm going to talk to them today. In the first hour, Rebecca, who's actually volunteering today at the Marbletown station. I talked to her yesterday, and so we're going to play the interview that I did with her in the first hour. Rebecca is a retired IBM software engineer. She's also the board chair of the unit, and she is, as I've mentioned, an EMS volunteer. And then in the second hour, Karen Pardini is going to be joining me live to talk about what she does. She is the chief of the unit. And on the side, she also raises and deploys search and rescue dogs, which is also another subject that I know virtually nothing about. And so we're going to talk about them, to them, about what they do and why they do it and how it's been, how their work has been affected by everything that's going on right now with COVID-19. But before I start the first interview with Rebecca, I wanted to just share a tidbit of information which I thought was interesting. First, a little bit about the Marbletown First Aid Unit. It was founded in 1961 and provides emergency medical response and ambulance transport 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They respond to 7 different fire districts within Marbletown, primarily Rosendale, Rochester, High Falls, Cottekill, Stone Ridge, North Marbletown, Cribblebush, Lyonsville, Vly Atwood, that was my fire station neighbor, and Lamontville. And MFAU, which is the acronym for the full name, was founded by High Falls resident Harriet Weber. And this is an interesting fun fact that I didn't know. She is considered the mother of emergency medical service in New York State. They had originally been named the Rondout Valley First Aid and Rescue, Inc., and have provided uninterrupted service since 1961. A little more on Harriet, there's a plaque representing an honor to her, and there is the Harriet Weber Leadership Award is conferred yearly by New York State Legislature on one who shows outstanding leadership in the EMS field. And their names are also etched in an Albany plaque bearing Harriet's name. And so I just thought that was really kind of cool that here's this woman. She passed, I'm going to get it wrong, but I think it was early 2000s. And so she's no longer with us, but her memory lives on in this really amazing service that is so vital to our community, a vital part of the fabric of our community. So I'm very excited to be able to talk to these two women. And without further ado, here is my interview with Rebecca Horner. All right. So Rebecca, thank you so much for making time to talk to me amidst all that's going on right now in the world. You are the board chair and one of the EMS volunteers over at the Marbletown First Aid Unit. And I am really so curious as to how this became a part of your life. I'll just say, I actually lived next to the Vly Atwood Firehouse.
Yes.
And
around, which is part of your district. Uh-huh. And so I would always, most of the reasons that the fire alarm went off was for EMS calls.
That's and true.
Yeah. So I have a very close perspective, yet I know virtually nothing about how all of this works. And so I would love to hear how you got connected with this work.
Well, it was something I wanted to try because I retired from IBM after 32 years. I liked volunteer work for a lot of years. I discovered many years ago that I really enjoyed it. It was giving of yourself with nothing coming back necessarily. And I thought, well, what can I do that's constructive and helpful? And I thought about Habitat for Humanity and ASPCA, but I didn't want to bring any more pets home. So I thought, well, let me do something else. And I'm still vigorous, physically strong enough to do this kind of work. And I thought, I can do this. I knew some people over the Marbletown First Aid Unit, and I decided to try. It was a 5-month course, and it was very intimidating. It's one of the hardest things I ever did, was to go through this EMT class. The book was 2 inches thick, and then we had a practical exam, and then we had another exam, a state exam, and it was really, really overwhelming. But I got through it. I did great. So I'm a volunteer EMT. It can be intimidating, but the thing that I'm told to remember is you're never alone. If you have a question, you stop and you ask somebody more experienced. So I'm just persevering. I'm just forging ahead, which is the only way you can approach it. And you always do good, and people appreciate you. That's the best part.
Yeah, I really think that people like yourself that do this work are really angels. And so I just want to pause right here to thank you for doing all of this. When did you first start this volunteer work?
About 4 years ago, I think. Yes, I recertified one time since I began. So yeah, it's been 4 years and I'm on duty 1 day a week. And that's, so I give the whole day to it. But of course, being board chair is pretty demanding, as it turns out. So it's another job.
Yeah. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the conversation, because it's an important job, especially as you're figuring out how funding, is going to work for supporting this very vital part of our community. So we're definitely going to talk about that. I'd be curious to know, just as far as like the training is concerned, when you say it's a 5-month course, was this something that you were going to a classroom for? Did you do it online? Was there a physical component to it?
Yes, it was. There was a class over at BOCES over in Port Ewan, and it was given by Mobile Life. It was 2 days a week. And it was not full-time 5 months. If I were studying to be an EMT, for example, it would be a year or two. So that's really intense. This is not quite as intense, but if you're new to it, it's a lot to absorb.
And so, what's the difference when you say if you were studying to be an EMT, like that's like a full-time person, or
is what I meant to say?
Okay.
Yeah, paramedic. They can do more invasive procedures like intubations, and they can administer medicines. So they have a lot more responsibility. But we don't have any paramedics at the Marbletown First Aid Unit. We have just basic EMTs.
Okay. Is that something that at all a goal to have a paramedic there, or is it pretty much okay the way that you're operating?
Well, we haven't talked about that at length. There are some agencies that do have paramedics. Ellenville, for example, has a couple of paramedics on their roster. We do have access to the Mobile Life Services and in Kingston. So they do back us up, and we have critical cases that need special care. So we rely on them. But most of the time, 80% of the time, the calls are what we call BLS, which is basic life support. So it's not critical. It's our job just to get them to a higher level of care, the hospital. That's our job.
And so then I guess that opens up the question that I was having, kind of thinking about, you know, what this is and how this is different than, you know, the paramedics that might come from a hospital. How do you get called? Like, how is that routed to you versus somebody else? Or is there not somebody else to call?
Well, every EMS agency has a district which they cover. So we are the first people to be called in the town of Marbletown.
So like if somebody calls 911, then that would go to you? Is that how that works?
No, actually it goes to a dispatch center up in Kingston. And they say, they look at the map and they say, okay, this call is in MFAU's district in their primary call area. So then we are notified through our pagers and through the radio that there's a call in our area, and we respond. We get in the rig, and the driver responds to dispatch and say, we're en route. So we tell them that we've assembled and that we're going to the call. So the dispatch up in Kingston decides who gets called. And if for some reason we weren't available, then we have a mutual aid agreement among other sister squads, like the Kronx and Accord First Aid Squad, or perhaps Ellenville, or perhaps Hurley. We each help each other when a unit isn't available. We could be out on another call somewhere and just not have a second crew available. So there is a very important network among all the rescue squads in Ulster County.
Wow, it's pretty interesting to think about the parallels that are kind of going on right now with, you know, community members coming together to try to get food out to people, you know, everything that's happening that's changed in our lives. And I'm just thinking about how this EMS system is there all the time, every day, 24/7.
Well, we hope that this attitude of cooperation continues after this coronavirus epidemic is over. We hope people just don't fall back into their own self-interested ways, and that perhaps some of these things will persist. I really believe it.
Yeah, I'm hopeful too. I mean, I'm sure it's not. I thought about it myself. My husband and I were actually talking about it. Like, what do we think is going to change? Will something change? And I'm hopeful that it will change for some people. It may not change for everyone, but if it affects some people to make different choices in their life,
yes,
you know, then there'll just be more people supporting the efforts like yourself,
yes,
and others who are volunteering. It's interesting to think about how you had this idea that you wanted to volunteer. And I used to, for a while, organize the volunteers for the O Positive Festival, which is a big arts and music festival in Kingston.
Oh, yes, I know. I used to live in Kingston.
Oh, yeah. And it was really such a beautiful experience. I mean, part of the reason, it was a harrowing job. It was just so time consuming. But there was such beauty in seeing the people come and feeling so alive, being a part of it and volunteering.
Yes.
And I wonder, you know, if you've ever thought about what inside of you comes alive when you volunteer. You know, what is it that feels, you know, that keeps you coming back to do this kind of work?
Well, you know, I think that we all need to leave some kind of legacy. It's a need to contribute. It's a need to be part of the community. That's the only way I can look at it. And now that I'm AMT, you see the immediate, the satisfaction, the gratitude that comes back to you. Lots of times, if I take somebody to the hospital, you know, you transfer care to the nurse in the hospital, and then I try to look at that person who's on the stretcher and wish them luck. And so often they'll just reach right out and hold your hand. Mm-hmm. So that's what's good for me. It's that personal connection. And of course I used to volunteer in Kingston. I was in the Art Society and part of the Sculptural Biennial and helped renovate Block Park down in Kingston and things like that. you see something that comes from your effort. Something builds, something grows. There's a good result. I think that's what you carry with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, do you remember the first call you ever went out on?
Well, you know, we were in training for a while, so I could be on many calls. But before the very first call that I went on by myself as a squad leader with just a driver, that was it was scary. I do remember clearly how my adrenaline was pumping. I mean, you really do react whenever the pager goes off, and then you try to get your brain organized. Just walking towards the ambulance, say, okay, it's this and that, and what do we need to consider? And so you're already getting yourself organized. Yeah, the first one I went on was very vague. The gentleman ended up having a stroke. Was not obvious. It took the hospital 2 days to figure it out. But all we could do was, you know, just sustain him, give him oxygen, get him to the hospital. But I had an experienced driver with me, so I felt not completely overwhelmed.
And so what does the setup kind of look like? You said that you're there for 1 day. Are you physically at some location for 1 day, or are you on call ready to move?
Well, you know, if I lived really close to squad house, to MFAU, like within a couple of minutes, I could probably be on duty from home. But I live over in Accord, which is 7 miles away or so.
Okay.
So I go to the squad building, and I just sit there and, you know, I do a rig check, an ambulance check, make sure the equipment's all in order, and we have enough of everything, and I might spend some time cleaning the floor or, you know, going online and taking a course or something like that. So I keep myself occupied. But we wait. We essentially sit there and wait. And it's kind of boring sometimes. Some days we'll have no calls, and other days we'll have two or three. So you never know what's going to happen. It's a little apprehensive. It's kind of stressful. If anybody tells you otherwise, they're not telling you the truth, because you just don't know what's going to happen next, or if it's going to be a difficult call or an easy call. So you just have to put on, I call it my actress hat. You put on your actress hat and you just step back from whatever emotions you're feeling and deal and just try to be calm. It makes such a big difference when you're dealing with somebody who's anxious, a patient who's anxious. So, it's a little stressful. You know, you can feel your heart jump every time that the pager goes off when you have a call. So it's,
And are there things that you do to try to reduce the stress? Is there anything that you have learned over these years that has been helpful to you?
Nothing specific. When I'm on duty, you know, I just try to keep my breathing nice and even, you know, through your nose, out through your mouth, that sort of thing. Like, okay, just calm yourself down. Because, of course, you think much more clearly when you're calm. You just cannot let yourself panic. That's the whole.
Well, and you know, my other work is as a yoga teacher and a meditation teacher.
Oh,
and so the simplest thing, like you've keyed into it, right? It's the breath. And if we can keep the breath at a smooth pace, it does work on the whole body system. To create that parasympathetic response to slow you down.
Yes.
So you're doing the right stuff.
Oh, good. And so right now, during this stressful time, I do find myself doing a little meditative eating. So that's always a constant worry. I really don't want to get on the scale in the morning. Okay, a little stress eating going on here.
I've had a lot of girlfriends who I've been texting with, like my college friends or my high school friends, and that's been the one thing. Like everyone's at home baking bread suddenly, and so it's like
all the comfort food,
all this bread. I don't mean to laugh because it's, you know, it's there's a lot of pain and suffering going on right now. But so when you are at the station, when you are on call, are you there by yourself or is somebody else there?
Well, there's at least one other person, usually the driver. The driver who's on duty with you at the same time, so that when a call comes in, you just get out into the rig and you get on the road as quickly as possible. We're usually on the road within a couple or 3 minutes, which is excellent. Occasionally, there might not be a full crew there, and so we call dispatch and we say we're assembling and we'll wait for somebody to come from home to make it a full crew. But it's usually just a matter of minutes. We try really hard to have a good response time.
And then how did you step into the board position?
Oh, because I'm a pushover. No, really, I joined the board of directors just as a helper, as a director. And then the current chair had put in 3 years and he wanted to step down. So somebody just said, well, how about Rebecca? Why don't you do it? You know, that sort of thing. And it just was as simple as that. So they voted and asked me to take the chair's role. And I was very flattered, completely naive about what it entailed. But it's okay. You know, it's an important job. It's a lot of desk work, a lot of communication. But I worked at IBM for 30 years. So, you know, I know how to communicate and write emails and keep people sort of pointed in the same direction. And that's what I'm trying to do, you know, set some goals and work towards it. And then we have a lot of strong personalities, a lot of impassioned people at the squad, very committed. So I'm not doing this by myself. Not at all. So it's a group effort. And I give everybody credit who's on the board. Everybody's working hard.
And when you say you're doing a lot of desk work and sending emails, what kind of work is that? Is it to the volunteers? Is it to other agents? You know, like, what is that work involving?
Well, it's mostly between among the board members ourselves. For example, you know, what policy do we want to write here, or how do we want to communicate to the town board? Or here's a news release that our PR man has put together, and let's talk about this. Do you approve it? Do you want to make changes? That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's just keeping the communication going and setting the direction that we want to go in. You know, we've made some big changes over the past year.
Well, and is one of those moving from all volunteer into a partially paid operation?
Yes, that was a big change that we made last September. The reason was because we couldn't get enough volunteers, and this is not a problem unique to us at all. It's a national problem. Last October, we organized a public forum over at the Rondell Valley High School, and we had about 70 people come. And we wanted to explain to them what was going on in the world as far as declining volunteerism, which was the impetus for our board to make the decision that we wanted to go part paid. And we were at about 60% response rate, which means we only had enough crew available to respond 60% of the time. And then we had to tap into the mutual aid system that I talked about. Now our duty roster is almost completely full. Our chief of operations is continually working to find new people. Our response rate is above 90%, 91, 94. Last month it was 97%. In other words, we are getting out the door to 97% of the calls that come in to our district, which is really amazing. It's really amazing. I mean, even some commercial squads can't boast to have numbers like that. So it was a necessity, and it was courageous on the board's part. It meant that until we figured out funding, we were sticking our necks out because we are tapping into our cash reserves in order to pay staff. Mm-hmm. But the, you know, we tried to say, okay, but what's the purpose of us being here as a rescue squad? The purpose is to serve the community. And that's the higher goal. We had to keep that in mind. And in the meantime, this last year, we're scrambling. We're scrambling to try to figure out funding. But our response rate is terrific, and the community is being taken care of, and that's our accomplishment.
I applaud you. I thought I'd just point out for, you know, anybody who's possibly curious, I have a very good friend who, she lives over in another county on the other side of the river. I don't even know what county that is. Columbia, maybe. But she went through the training to become a volunteer fire person. And it's part of that, she does now do these types of calls. You know, a lot of that work is doing the EMS calls. Yes. And so I just thought I'd share, like, you know, I've never considered it myself. It's sort of just, it's never kind of come into my thinking. But when my friend did it, I just was really impressed by her decision to do this and, you know, the commitment that it takes on her part, but also like this new camaraderie that she's experiencing. You know, it's just such an interesting part of our community that many of us probably take for granted exists.
Oh, yes, people do take it for granted. They just know that if they call dial 911, that somebody's going to come to help them. And they don't understand this is a living, breathing entity behind the scenes that has to be paying attention the whole time. Yeah, it is another community. It is another group. And as a retired person, I find myself looking for ways to be sociable. Even though I'm basically an introverted person, I still need those social connections. Mm-hmm. And for example, I'm a Master Gardener volunteer with the Cornell Extension. That's another of my fun groups. And, you know, I take art classes. So there's my other group of people who I enjoy, but we need that in our lives. We need those social connections. I've met some really interesting people at the rescue squad. And
it's a diverse group of people, you know. When you're working with artists, it's kind of, you know, not to say every artist is the same, but it's sort of like a, you know, they all have a little something in common. Whereas to me, the rescue squad seems like you could be pulling from people from all different backgrounds. I won't name my friend because she's kind of a public figure who's doing this volunteer work, but if anybody knew she was doing it, like, they would be so surprised.
Yes. Well, you're right. It is a diverse group. Varying degrees of education, varying degrees of work experience. We've had people go on to be nurses and physician's assistants and paramedics. Sometimes it's a stepping stone to a much more challenging career. We have people who are climbing guides. One lady was a midwife, and another lady was a nurse. It's very amazing. And so if I'm on duty with somebody other than the normal person, it's fun to talk to them. It's fun to understand what their life is like. And we have people from the community on the board as well, so they might have a more of a business background. You're right, it's really diverse.
And so then, are there any like prerequisites? Do you have to go through any screening before you start training to become an EMT?
Well, I don't know what the criteria is specifically. I think you have to come in without a criminal record. I think that's probably the only thing. And a good, clean driver's license. And, you know, so I don't think there is anything. Mm-hmm. I certainly didn't have any medical background when I got started. Yeah, there's just a basic background check that our chief does when she talks to people. And you have to have the interest, and then you have to get through the course and do well. And a lot of people will train to be drivers. I'm not a driver.
So that's a separate training?
It is a separate training. And most EMTs are drivers as well, so they switch roles occasionally. But I was just too intimidated by the 7-ton machine that is the ambulance. It's a great big machine. So it was something that I didn't care to do, and I'm fine with that.
Well, it's good to know for anybody else who might say, I'm not ready to drive something like that. They can still volunteer.
Sure. And you can volunteer without even having an official role. I mean, you can come in and wash the ambulance for us once in a while. We do have volunteer jobs too.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
And how long do people usually stay a volunteer? I mean, is there any kind of requirement to be, you know, signed up, committed for a certain period of time, or what does that look like?
Not really. I think the only commitment is that you put in 6 hours a week. I think that's the number. It might be 12 hours a week. I'm not positive, but it's not a lot of hours per week. You commit to that much, and you can resign anytime if you reach a point that you don't want to do it for some reason, or you can't do it anymore, or something else pulls you away. It is volunteer. Mm-hmm. And even the people who are getting paid now could step away at any time. There's no contract, is what I'm saying. So people do it because it makes them feel good, and they find it satisfying.
And so then where are you getting your funding from? I looked on your website. There is, I think, a reference to, you know, some town funding and then support from the community. What does that funding initiative look like for you as the board president?
We do get a lot of generous contributions from the community. We have a fund drive once a year. I think this year, the community gave us $30,000, which was the best year yet. Most of our income comes from insurance billing, so that when we transport somebody from a scene to a hospital, there's insurance money that comes back to us through the person's insurance, and that's the most substantial part of our income right there. It's because we are an autonomous EMS agency, we're a nonprofit, that we're allowed to bill insurance companies. If we were an EMS service that's part of a fire company, like Woodstock, for example, we would not be able to collect any insurance money. So the insurance money is a big part of our income. It's probably the largest part, and it sustains us. The town of Marbletown right now is contributing $20,000 a year, which is a small help. We are working with them to find more funding for us, because right now, as I mentioned, we are tapping into our cash reserves in order to pay for employees, so that our duty roster can be full, so that we can get out 97% of the time. So, you know, it's we're in a position of quandary. We need more money, and we're looking for ways to do that. So we're working with the town. We have a couple ideas. We know that in other townships, like in the town of Olive, for example, the town gives their rescue squad nearly $300,000 a year.
It's
an all-paid squad. But they commit to having an ambulance and a crew on 24 hours, 7 days a week. And they get out almost 100% of the time. So it works very well in Olive. And there are other townships that do the same. It costs a lot of money to keep the ambulances running, to keep a roof over our heads, buy the medical supplies, you know, and buy the oxygen and so on. Shandaken gives their rescue squad $500,000 a year. New Paltz is $244,000, I think, they get from their town. So other townships are very, very generous.
What's going on, Marble Town? Come on.
Well, okay. I don't want to say much more than I've said, but
yeah, we get the picture. We get the picture.
A point of frustration, but we're not giving up. We do have an idea. We have something we have proposed to them. We hope they're thinking about it. It's a structure called an ambulance improvement district, and it's analogous to a library district, which a lot of towns have. It means it's basically a regular tax that's given to the people. So it would provide EMS steady and safe and consistent funding. If you look at your tax bill now, you would see, there's a general tax levy, and then you'll see fire. You might see a water bill. In some townships, like Saugerties, where they do have an ambulance improvement district, you will see an ambulance tax. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people get used to paying this, and it's according to assessed value of your property. But then EMS is given a nice substantial amount of money every year to keep the agency going and to keep the EMS service alive in the community. So this is the idea we have. I don't know how the other townships handle it, although I do know that Saugerties, the Diaz Memorial Ambulance Service, is supported through an ambulance improvement district. They have a large township. I think they have 19,000 people, but the town gives them $700,000 a year to keep their agency alive. They do pay for paramedics. They have a very elite squad up there. It's impressive. It's impressive. And I just hope that we can look forward to that in Marble Town someday.
Well, I do too. Can you share at all if there have been any changes, you know, in what you're doing because of what's happening right now with the virus? Have you had different calls, more calls, new calls? Has your practice, you know, the processes around how you're doing things changed at all?
Well, yes, the complexion of the calls have changed a little bit. We're getting fewer traumas, fewer car accidents. I think people are home and they're staying safe. We are getting more calls for people with difficulty breathing. We've had several, I don't know the exact number, the chief would know that, calls which are for patients which are COVID positive. We are using a lot of protective equipment, more gear. We're using our N95 masks. We also have face shields. We have the special Tyvek aprons to put on. And of course, we always wear gloves to protect our hands. Even if it were a basic, you know, broken ankle kind of call, we always wear gloves to protect ourselves. So a lot of personal protective equipment, more than usual. We're hyper vigilant about keeping the rigs decontaminated and disinfected, wiping down things everywhere we go, you know, so we're hyper vigilant about keeping the whole environment sanitized and keeping ourselves safe. I mean, we have to be safe. Well, one of the first things we learned in class was basic protective equipment, and is the scene safe? You know, you go into a scene and you have to stop and pause and say, is it safe for me to be here? For example, if we have somebody with a mental health issue, you might want to let the police step in first before you offer your help. So you pause for a second and check the scene. And now we're being very, very, very careful about our own safety, because if we're not safe, the patient's not safe. We're instructed not to enter people's houses immediately as we would normally do. We can talk to the patient from the front door and say, well, has this happened? What are you feeling? Have you had this experience? What are your symptoms? And if they're able, we ask them to walk out of their house. They might not be able to, and then we'll have to go in and help them. But so the approach is different now that the coronavirus is among us. We're more careful, and we have a whole different way of protecting ourselves and handling the patient. We put a mask on the patient, gloves on the patient. We wrap them up in the sheet so they can't touch anything, and get them to the hospital right away.
And what about your personal life, you know, outside of this work? How has your life shifted because of everything that we're going through with the virus and the physical distancing?
Well, I am definitely at home, as everybody else is. I go out for walks as often as I can. I'm taking my exercise class online. My teacher provides a video. She doesn't know that I'm hardly ever doing it, but I have the video there, so I try. yeah, I'm trying to stay more active, but thank goodness the sun is out. I'm out in the garden. And then my kids are adults, so they live nearby, and I stay in touch with them on the phone. A lot more phone work, that's for sure. A lot more Zoom meetings, which is sometimes hard to handle the video meetings, but it's working. You know, we're getting through it. Everybody's coping and adapting. I went to the grocery store this morning. It was very odd. They're limiting the people in the store. People are keeping their distance from each other. People are keeping their distance from each other. They have arrows on the floor, so you're supposed to keep the traffic going in a particular direction. It's hard not to be able to hug people. You know, you go up, you see a friend, and the reflex would be just to hug them. And it's odd for everybody. I think it's going to be a long time before people trust that they can do that safely. It is creating this odd barrier among people. I think we're all feeling very anxious about it. I was thinking the other day that trying to figure out what I was feeling. And I think, you know what? I'm just anxious. There's this floating anxiety everywhere, and everybody's feeling it. So I chat with people on the phone, or if I'm out walking, you know, you talk across the street from each other, mm-hmm. instead of walking up to someone. It's an isolating environment, and some people aren't coping with it very well. You can imagine that some people are struggling more than others.
Do you know people who are connected to you that are having a difficult time?
Well, I have a son who has the symptoms. He lives up near Albany, and he's I talk to him every day. Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't talk to him, but, you know, once a week, once every 2 weeks, just because he's a grown-up guy. I said, I'm calling you every day. I don't care if you don't like it or not, but I'm calling you every day, and I want to know what's going on and what your temperature is and so on. And can I bring you some groceries and so on? So it's, you're much more attentive to your relationships and to the people you love.
Yeah, I've found it that, I've actually kind of reconnected with people that I don't talk to regularly. You know, it's like a long time ago. Have you experienced any of that?
Yes, I have. And people reach out to me and vice versa. You reach out to people and just say, how are you? You know, just checking in. I see you. That's what you do. It's a comfort to everybody.
Well, I am really grateful for you giving us this time today. We're recording this conversation in ahead of time because you are on duty tomorrow when this actually be airing. It's hard for me to figure out how to talk about those things. It's like this time warp. So hopefully you'll actually be dialing in a little bit later in the show so we can kind of check in with you on how you're doing at the station and just to say hello, just to connect one more time.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Teresa.
Thank you, Rebecca. And bye-bye. And we'll share the links to the website and, you know, when you do your annual fundraiser, just let me know and we can push that out on social media as well.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks, Rebecca, for holding down Squad House. I didn't realize that was
the name for it. I think I was calling it the unit or something, but that's like the cool insider term of squad house. So I'm learning so much new language today. I wanted to insert a deep thought in the middle of the interview today, in the middle of the show. I was listening to this Alanis Morissette song, Thank You. It was probably a few months ago. And I just, I was never a huge Alanis fan. Not like I don't like her, but I just wasn't, I don't know. She's just not in like my regular mix, my regular rotation of songs. But for some reason I had listened to this song. I think it was played on the radio. And I just felt such a deep emotional connection to it. And I wanted to sing it from every pore of my body. And I don't even know what the words are. You know, I just sort of like, think I'm making the sounds of words. Maybe I know some of them, but I'm not actually making like a cognitive like assessment of what I'm saying. And for some reason, just like a week or so ago, I'm like, what are the words to this song? Because I keep having this impulse of like wanting to sing it. And so I looked up the words and they still didn't make a lot of sense to me. And it's like, thank you, India. Thank you, terror. And I'm like, what is she talking about? It sort of was confusing me because it was taking away my emotional connection to the song. And so I did a little research online about if there was anyone who had said anything about the meaning of the song. And I had come across one person's interpretation, and I just sort of quickly glanced at it. And it was this idea that these were all really difficult things that had been, she had gone through in her life, that she was basically saying thank you to for the opportunity to experience them, and whatever the growth was or whatever that experience was, she was seeking to find some gratitude in it. And I just thought about how that might be relevant for some people right now with everything that's going on, whether you're experiencing, you know, personal loss, you know, of a loved one, or feeling sick yourself, or just the challenges with things being taken away from your normal routine, connections, et cetera. And if there is a way for us to find some gratitude in it, you know, I actually started, for some reason the other day, when I was referring to what was going on, I called it the global awakening instead of the global pandemic. And that's not to minimize the seriousness of it, but I do, for me personally, connect to it as this opportunity for awakening, because so much is changing in our life. So much of the foundation of what's normal for us and our routines is changing. And while it can be unstabilizing and a little bit scary, that change opens up a way for us to do things differently. And so I feel like this is really an opportunity for awakening. And then before I was getting ready for the show today, and I was planning to play this song, which you'll hear a little bit later for everyone who's listening on the radio, you'll hear it after these announcements. But I was like, I should probably just research this song a little bit more before I start pontificating about it. And I actually found this interview. It's apparently from VH1 Storyteller's appearance that Alanis Morissette did. And she talks about this song. And I just wanted to read this. She says, I felt that I lived in a culture that told me that I had to consistently and constantly look outside myself to feel this elusive bliss. And I achieved a lot of what society had told me to achieve, and I still didn't feel peaceful. I started questioning everything, and I realized that actually everything was an illusion and really beautiful. An illusion, and it was scary for me because everything I had believed in was dissolving in front of me, and there was a death of sorts, a really beautiful one ultimately, but at first a very scary one. And so I stopped. I stopped for the first time, and I was overcome with a huge sense of compassion for myself first. And then naturally that translated into my feeling and compassion for everyone around me, and a huge amount of gratitude that I had never felt before to this extent. And that's why I had to write this song, Thank You, because I had to express how exciting this was and how scary it was, and all of these opportunities for us to define who we are. So if that's helpful for, to anyone, feel free. I'll share those words in the show notes if you want to return to them for any inspiration or wisdom.
Yay, this is so cool. An interactive interview right now with Karen Pardini, who has joined us via Zoom. So I get to see her. This is so exciting. And to those who might be just tuning in, I mentioned earlier, Karen is the chief of the Marbletown First Aid Unit. And in addition to that, she also raises and deploys search and rescue dogs. And so we're going to get into some of that, talking about all of this stuff. But, you know, I was just thinking how it's kind of a cool title to be called chief.
Oh, yeah, and it is. I accept congratulations and I accept condolences. No, I'm serious. I accept congratulations on this. Yes.
Yeah. Totally. No, it's a nice accomplishment. And can you just tell us a little bit what it means to be chief of this EMS team?
So I'm sitting here at the squad building right now. I'm in my office and we're all separated by social distancing. Rebecca, who you spoke with earlier, just 3 minutes ago went out on a call for somebody who was having difficulty breathing, and respiratory precautions were recommended for our team. So everybody, the driver and Rebecca, are all suiting up, wearing the little white bunny outfits and goggles and masks and gloves. And when they get to the patient, they're going to be doing the same thing. But here in the office right now, I'm just working on different protocols that are coming in. Everything is changing rapidly with the virus upon us and the apex rolling towards the apex. So there's a lot going on. There's a lot of changes. I do updates all the time for my team so that they can stay abreast of what's happening inside here with our team and outside. My job on day to day can change. My real job here as chief, of course, is to make sure that operations is running smoothly and that the team is good and the team is happy. So that's sort of it in a nutshell, but it goes on and deep.
How many people are on the team?
There's approximately 30 of us, but that doesn't mean that everybody is active. So there's always people in the volunteer world and, you know, that are here sometimes and not here others. We do have some people now that for health reasons are not going to be with us for at least a month until this blows over because of, you know, feeling protection for their family or themselves, whatever the case may be. So we have like 3 people out with that, right? You know, taking care of themselves.
Right. So that's one of the ways that you're being impacted with the work that you do with the virus. What are some of the other things that you've had to change? I know Rebecca mentioned some of it, of not going into the homes necessarily unless it's absolutely necessary. What are the things that you're kind of having to stay abreast of and then, you know, implement different practices because of that?
So one of the things that happens during this is that we have the donning and the doffing of the equipment that we put on. And the donning is the putting on of the equipment and the doffing is the taking off. And in order to do that, you have to be very, very specific and very, very exact. Like you don't want anything to go past your eyes and your face, so you bend over when you take things off. The ambulance needs to be decontaminated. Everything needs to be washed down, taken down. It's very, very time consuming and intense. Those are the things that have changed dramatically. The time, the intensity, being on the front line, going to these homes, knocking on the door, asking the questions. Anybody sick in here? Do you have a fever? Do you have a cough? Has anybody in your home had a fever or a cough? Working out the smallest little details. And so what I find is that being accurate and organized are really, really important during this time.
Has it required you to work longer hours?
I am working more hours. I'm doing more fill-ins where necessary, just so that we are 100% out the door when we need to be. I think it's intense on the front lines for everybody right now, for EMS and for everybody in the hospital. It's a time when we all have to stay really focused and really cognizant of what is around us. Our perception, or my perception, has totally changed in terms of how to go forward with this virus. And I'm looking at everything around me as if it's contaminated.
So that's how you're kind of viewing both your work and your personal life. It's changing just the way that you look at all the little aspects of what you do every day. Is that what you're referring to?
Everything, but mostly here at the squad, because at home I feel more relaxed. I know it's my home. Mm-hmm. That's my sanctuary. That's where I can go and relax and not worry about cleaning the table 100 times or washing my hands 100 times. But out here in the world, I'm washing my hands a lot. I'm using sanitizer. I'm really on it. And I don't even know if that's enough. You know, we don't know. But I am very positive, and I am really working hard to make sure that my team is safe and we have all the personal protection equipment that we need. And I stay on top of that on a daily basis and on the computer all the time trying to find extra equipment.
Well, and that makes me think, you know, the sort of some of the information that was coming out about whether it's airborne, you know, how is it actually transferred to one person? People thinking that maybe it's you know, changing then from the way we originally thought it was passed from one person to the next. And that must be the really kind of creating stress because you don't know exactly how it can be caught.
That's true. We don't know. So that's why we take the protection of wearing a mask all the time. We don't go into the hospital without a mask and gloves on. And I'm really careful about my patients, whether they are medically being transported or COVID transport. I make sure that they have a mask and I put gloves on them and I burrito them in a sheet so that one, our ambulance is safer, and two, they are safer when they go into the hospital.
What are the types of equipment that you're finding yourself running low on?
Surgical masks. Everybody who's been fitted for an N95, which is an 8511, it's a 3M, it's a better fitted mask. The fitted masks are starting to dwindle a little bit, but I still have enough for my team. We don't use those on the patients. We use surgical masks, but those are starting to dwindle a little bit. So I'm on the lookout for those. And we do have a lot of friends who, of course, are making masks, which I encourage everybody to wear one when they're out in the world.
Yeah, I'm enjoying the fashion statement of some of the masks that I'm seeing being made. They're quite beautiful, actually.
Some of them are amazing. My husband wears one that has cards all over it. He doesn't play cards, but he has one that has cards all over it and dice.
That's great.
With a coffee filter now, in it.
I didn't realize that. That's brilliant. Let's go back in time. And, you know, how did you get into this work? When did you first start to do EMT work?
I started to do EMT work in the late 70s, early 80s. I'm a midwife by trade. And so being an EMT was just a natural because I really did want to know that if any of my clients needed to be transported, that they were being transported with care and that I could be with them and do the follow through. So, because they were home birth patients, and that got me into being an EMT. And then I stopped doing that for a long period of time. And I bounced into another aspect of medical, working in refugee camps in Africa and on a disaster medical team. So I've been a consistent midwife now for over 20 years. And the disaster work is interesting because I'm down in Texas and Puerto Rico. I worked in Haiti for a year and a half, and I love doing that kind of work.
And so when you talk about working in refugee camps, where are the places that you work to do that? In Texas and
no,
in Africa,
in Guinea, West Africa, I worked with Liberian refugees and with other refugees from other countries that were coming in. And that was great work. And then in Haiti, I helped set up medical domes. I worked with Wyclef Jean with Yele Haiti. And Disaster Medical is a federal team. And there I worked in Texas. I worked in Katrina. I've worked in Puerto Rico, different states.
What is it that you think draws you to that kind of work?
I'm comfortable with the adrenaline rush, I guess. I don't know. Interesting question. I'm a dancer, and I find that movement, that fast movement, and that making decisions and having to make a decision is what I like. I really like going forward and moving forward and being in the moment and being there. And that's what EMT is. It is really being in the moment. You have to make a decision in the moment. It's not something where you get in there and it's like, well, gee, let me think about that for a minute and I'll get back to you. It's like, no, you have to be there and you have to be centered and you have to do it. And you have to do it with grace and with empathy and with street sense and street knowledge, using all of the book work that and the book knowledge that you've accumulated. It's an interesting balance. That's the balance that I like in my life. I like it all. Music and yeah, I'm there.
Did you have any role models as a younger person that worked in the medical field? How did you end up kind of getting into the midwifery and then, you know, pursuing this different type of, you know, really like medical services in a sense?
In the beginning, I actually knew somebody that had a home birth, and then I wanted to have a home birth. And then I became a midwife. I worked with a doctor here in Kingston. He mentored me for many years. And then I became actually friends with Ina May down at the farm in Tennessee. And I worked with LeBoyer, Dr. LeBoyer, doing water births. He taught me how to do that. So I've had a lot of really good teachers. And it just became natural to move into medical and work in medical. It's been something it's just a natural for me. I'm so comfortable in it.
And how often are you at the squad house?
Almost every day.
Okay.
I do a 12-hour shift on Tuesday, and then I'm here almost every other day. I mean, every day for a few hours. And if there's a need for me to get up in the middle of the night, I do that too. So.
Well, one of the things that Rebecca was talking about when I spoke with her was, you know, how you work to build up the team so that you have a full, what is it, roster, duty roster is pretty much full. And yes. How much of your work is involved with that, of like recruiting or reviewing? Like, do you review potential applicants and make decisions about who can join the team? How does that all work?
So when a person has an interest to become a driver or an EMT or to join the team, then they come in, they fill out an application. I interview them, find out why they would like to work with us and what their interests may be and how we can help them achieve that role that they're looking at. Then the information goes to the board. I recommend to the board whether we should put them on probationary status or not. The board gives me the decision. Yes, if I think they're good enough. And then we start training with them. If they're going to be a driver, if they're going to be an EMT, then they have to go to school. They have to work on all of the different aspects of helping out at the squad, coming on as a third. So riding in the back of the ambulance and learning if that's what they really want to do. A lot of people come into this and realize that it could be overwhelming for them, and that's something that they really are comfortable doing. So it's nice if they can find another avenue to help out. Some just want to be drivers then. Some like to do auxiliary work at that point and can help out that way. Any help, of course, is welcomed, and we're looking for good people always. So to build the team, it takes a lot of work, and the training of a new EMT takes a lot of time. If they've never had a medical background before, then a lot of training goes into helping that person get to the point where they're comfortable taking care of a patient.
And Rebecca had alluded to the 5 months of training. Is that something that the applicant pays for? You know, how does that work from a financial perspective?
So to become an EMT in New York State, they offer classes during in January to June, and then from September to December. You enter into a class, you pay for the class, it's about $750, and then you also have on top of that the book cost, which is another $250, I think. If you belong to a squad before you enter the class, then I can write fill out a form saying that you are with the squad. At the end of that course, if you graduate that course, the state will reimburse for that course.
Oh, well, that's good to know.
I know, it is good. It's good incentive, an incentive that we definitely need to get people into the program and become EMTs.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, I posted on social media on about these interviews, and a woman had responded to the post saying that she's actively looking for recruits in all these different states. I don't really know. I didn't dig into it to understand like who she was and who she was working for, but you know, and she was like listing the rates of pay that people can get paid and all this stuff. And I just thought, wow, you know, why is it that there is such a need, such a void of people to do this, particularly if there are being, you know, offered paid positions? Do you have any insight into why it might be difficult to get people in on board with this?
Okay. This is where we start getting into the nitty gritty of what really goes on the backside of EMS. EMS is the redheaded stepchild of emergency services all over the country. And what do I mean by that? I mean that it's low-paying job, it's hard hours, it's hard work, and the certification is not a license. It's a certification. That certification has to be renewed every 3 years in New York State. It's hard working. You, on top of everything else that you're doing, and it's usually 12-hour shifts if you're in commercial services, and in a lot of volunteer or partially paid services, it also is a 12-hour shift. It's difficult to get low pay as an EMT and as a driver and be doing this really, really important work. A lot of people want to get into it, and then they realize, ugh, I got to get out of this. So the dedication has to really come from the heart to be in this, because it's not something you're going to get rich on.
It's not surprising to me, I guess, to hear all of that. It's just another, another example of how our values as a community, as a society, are so misaligned. You know, thinking about just everything that we're going through right now. And I'm hoping that by having some of these things taken away from us, not necessarily EMT, EMS services, but just some of the other things that we are learning aren't just automatically, you know, we get very comfortable in at least our Western world to have anything we want at our fingertips. And with some of that being taken away, maybe it'll help us really start to evaluate what's important to us. Because it's just shocking to me that
there isn't money for this, but then there's, you know, plenty of money flowing in other directions. So I'll get off my little soapbox.
No, what you're saying is true though. There's so much money for other things, and literally it is things. And then when you look at emergency services, we are so deeply in need, of money to exist. And it just isn't there. It's just not there. The grants are not there like they are for fire departments. Yet fire departments and emergency ambulance services are finding that it's better separated, not under the same roof, because to be an ambulance service, we can charge an insurance company. But a fire department, if we were under a fire department roof, we would not be able to charge the insurance company. So there's all these little things that enter into it. It is a tangled web. And in this case, nobody's trying to deceive anybody. It's just a tangled web. And EMS does not get what it needs to survive. Period.
Okay, Karen. I wanted to just bring up this subject. One of the phrases that Rebecca shared when I talked to her was this attitude of cooperation, which is something that we're seeing more members of the community really come together to help people who are in need right now. And Rebecca had made a statement about how, you know, you all had hoped that this attitude of cooperation continues even once we're on the other side of this virus. And I wonder if you could just paint a picture of, you know, the feeling, the emotional state at the squad, you know, that I imagine that there's some level of camaraderie that you all have with one another of, you know, coming together to do this work that really is so vital in the community. And if that is part of the reason that you continue to do this work, you know, you talked about the challenges with it and some of the reasons why you struggled to get members, but what are some of the real beautiful ways that you find connection through the work that you're doing?
We are such an incredibly diverse group. It's wild. It's wild. I mean, we go all the way from politically from one end of the spectrum down to the other end of the spectrum, even with conspiracy theorists right in the middle there. So it's so interesting. And we have people that have never left our area, who've never traveled. And then we have people who've just traveled and lived abroad and were born abroad, and just so, and their educational differences. It's so interesting, and we all bring something so important to the table. And what I've found in the past, now we can't do it, but in the past when we've had big emergencies and hurricanes and we have to sleep overnight, we have big dinners together at the table, and we all cook together and we all work it out together. And it's the same way now, except that we have our social distancing, but we know that we're all there and we're all checking in with each other, and we're texting, and I'm sending out team updates on a daily basis and calling people, and, you know, office people are getting in touch with people, and we're making sure that we're all okay and what our needs are. And when we're here as a crew, we just wait for the tones to drop so we can get in the rig and roll it. And that, we know our work. So it's so interesting because it doesn't feel any different in terms of knowing our work. We know our work. As I said in a paper that I wrote, this is our wheelhouse. This is what we do. So it's a comfort to know that you're working with somebody that you really feel good about working with. I love working with my driver. I think he's wonderful. And Beth, who is also one of my drivers. I love my crews and I love working with them.
It's funny. I was at the
physical therapist yesterday, and he was asking me what's going on. And I was telling him about this interview and who, you know, that I was going to have women from the Marbletown First Aid Unit. And he is like, Beth? And I was like, no, I don't know Beth, but Beth has a fan out there.
Oh, yeah. Beth's got a lot of fans. Mm-hmm. Yes. And we're all, I mean, there's a lot of great women here. Being that you're doing a women's show, there's a lot of great women here. And there's a lot of great guys. There's a lot of great women. I feel very lucky to have such a great squad that I can be chief of operations of. I love the intellectual aspect of this squad and how everybody approaches their work and how people are on scene. I feel like we are professional. We get it done and we know what we're doing. And it feels good. You know, I was thinking, you know, with the whole decontamination of the ambulances and looking for equipment, we have been looking for foggers, which the Ryobi is this company, and they make these foggers, and we have not been able to find them or able to get them. But it turns out Beth's stepdaughter in Atlanta was able to track one down at a store. The truck was coming in at 6 a.m. She got up at 5:30 in the morning the other day and got to that store at 6 a.m. and grabbed one off the truck. And so it's arriving here today or tomorrow, and we'll be able to fog. And I just got a text from somebody from Mobile Life, who works at Mobile Life. They just got a fogger at their Hurley Fire Department and their rescue squad. And they're like, anytime you need to fog, just come on over and we'll fog the back of your machine for you, your rig for you. And then yesterday we were coming back from a call. We were coming through Rosendale on the main street, and some people were on the side. And as we passed, they all started clapping and cheering for us. Aww. I almost had tears in my eye. I was so overwhelmed with gratitude. And I think that's what everybody is feeling towards another person right now is, I'm so happy to see you. I have gratitude in my heart for everything that we are all doing to help each other and be there with each other and listen to each other. We're not rushing the way we used to rush. We're rushing in a different way. And some people are rushing in fear, but we're rushing in a different way. And it's to encompass and close that circle that we need each other so much right now. And yesterday I really felt that in that moment when those people were cheering on the side of the road. It was like, wow, I'm so touched. Thank you.
Thank you, people, for showing your love. I think that's really important right now for everyone to realize how much they are appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if we could just switch gears a little bit, because I'm curious to know a little bit about the search and rescue work and the dog training that you do. How did you get into that kind of work?
I've always had dogs, love dogs. I worked with training with somebody who had a dog training called Companion Dogs. I became a trainer with him. And since 2007, I've been on a search and rescue team, Eagle Valley Search Dogs. We do a lot of searches. In fact, this morning, actually, there was a possibility that I was going to have to go out on a search, but the person walked out of the woods, so I didn't have to go. I was happy about that, and I'm happy she self-extricated herself. But it's a great, I love doing it. It's hard work. It's great work. You never know when you're going to go out. I can get a call at 2 a.m. I can get a call at 6 a.m. It's very much like doing EMS work. You know, you never know when you're going. And when you go, you got to be ready to go and just get in the vehicle and go. So I have two work dogs, two German Shepherds. One is from Germany. One is from German Czech lines. They're both working line. And it takes about 1.5 to 2 years to train a dog for certification. My dogs are certified for live find, HRD, human remains, and water, and article search. And my young one, who's 3, he's HRD, human remains trained. I am also training him for some trailing right now. So it's you have to, it's a lot of work because we have to also know navigation, how to use maps, how to plan a search, how to go forward and be out there for 5-6 hours at a time with the dog working.
I don't know if it's possible, but you know, to me, my brain wants to kind of like get a picture of what it looks like. Like you get a call, it could be any time of the day, you get a call, and then it's, what's happening then? Is somebody saying, this is the area that you need to go to? How does that all work? And
right.
then what are you actually doing?
So I get a call. I get a call that there's a person missing. They've been missing for possibly half an hour, an hour, or they may have been missing for days. Who knows? But I'm to come to a staging area. Usually the staging area is at a fire department, or it could be at a law enforcement office. From there, there's usually somebody from the DEC. If it's in the wilderness, there's somebody from the DEC who has mapped out areas, usually 100-acre areas. And they say, this is the area that you will be searching. And we have a radio. We get out there with the dog. We radio in that we're ready to begin our search. And we start. And we're usually gone for 5 to 6 hours searching the area, unless we find the person. We've also been called in. We've worked with the FBI doing cold cases. So that's a little easier because we know exactly where we're going and what we're going to be doing. And the area that we're going to be searching is always a little bit smaller. And the same thing with human remain cases. If it's not a live find, you generally know when you're going to go out. It's, you don't have to run out with immediately in within 5 minutes. So human remains is an easier certification in terms of having more time, because generally you know it's going to be on a weekend, or it's going to, they ask you to come in the following day. There's usually a flanker with us, somebody who goes with us so they can help us navigate. They can help us if we need help getting across something or carrying something for us. We don't go out alone with just the dog. That would not be safe. And we always have radio contact. We have our maps with us. We have GPS. My dog wears a GPS, so I know where he or she is at all times. My dogs don't stay right next to me. They go out in front of me. My girl, she'll travel out in front of me sometimes, you know, a couple thousand feet when she gets scent of something or somebody.
And this is a naive question because I haven't a clue, but so what did the dog, how do the dogs know what they're going out and looking for? Like you see in the movies, like they have a piece of clothing that belonged to the person and they smell it and then they go off into the woods. But what does it look like in real life?
So in real life, picture a dog's nose is like a stew. They, you know, in the stew, there's carrots, potatoes, meat, oregano, onions, garlic. So we smell stew and we like, wow, smells great, that stew. The dog goes, I smell all those ingredients. If we are not trailing, we are doing what we call a live search, a live find, and the dog will smell any human being out there. I don't have to give my dog a piece of the person's clothing. I just tell my dog to search, and my dog puts its head into the air, and off we go. I'll grid my area. In other words, I'll walk with the wind coming towards my face, and I'll grid my area, so I'll go across it. I may go across it for, you know, 3,000 feet, and then I turn and I come back the other way, 100 feet separated from that line. So my dog actually learns how to use a grid map with me. And then when the dog gets scent and smells a person, the dog will take off. She'll throw her head up in the air. I know the body language, and I will follow her. And that's how live find works without trailing. We don't need a piece of the person's clothing. The dog smells any human being out there. So yes, have we found other search teams? Yes.
Okay.
And then we just go, good girl, good dog. Let's go back to work, and off we go again.
I don't know if you know the answer to this. I don't watch a lot of television, but it seems like that would make for a very good reality TV show. Do you know if any exist on that work?
No, I don't think there's any reality TV shows on that. But yeah, it probably would. It would probably be fun. It would be like live search and rescue instead of live PD.
Yeah.
Which is a television program.
I was just checking the Instagram account for I Want What She Has podcast, because earlier today I had posted that I was going to be interviewing you, Karen, and Joanne LaFeld, otherwise known as the Mula Doula, who has been a guest on the show, wrote a comment that Karen is a force. I had the pleasure of meeting years ago. I look forward to hearing what she has to say. And it just made me think about, you know, this idea of, you know, doing this kind of work is challenging work. And do you ever have moments where you feel frightened or worried? You know, does any of that come up for you at all? Or are you, as Joanne described, this force, you know, who cannot be intimidated?
I think I can be intimidated very easily, but I feel when I'm doing this work, I come from a different center. I really do come from a different center. My midwifery work, my EMS work, my medical work, my disaster medical work, I really am comfortable in it. Like I said before, I really have a center that is, it's there. I don't even know how to explain it. I know that, and I also know that we're not alone in this work. I feel like we have the power to keep around us who we want to be part of a team. And I think that's really important. I feel really strongly that I advocate for women and for my patients and for the people that I see on the road. I really advocate for them. I want them to have the best care possible, and I want them to be given to the best care possible. And I know it's difficult out there, even in good times, to get great care. But I really care that people have that and that they are well taken care of when I am in their presence. It means a lot to me to be able to give to them.
One, I had mentioned in my conversation with Rebecca about a friend of mine who had become recently a volunteer firefighter. And one of the things that she's shared with me is, I think there's only one other woman on the fire squad. And I wonder what your experience has been like being a woman doing this kind of work. Have you ever had experienced any particular challenges because you're a woman? Or you mentioned how you advocate for women. And so maybe, you know, you've had to kind of push through some difficult times, or maybe just by the nature of who you are, it hasn't been that way. But I'd be curious to know what your experience has been in that regard.
I think that your friend who is a firewoman, I think she has a lot more to break through, because that is definitely a man's world. You don't find a lot of women out there. It's definitely a man's team. And kudos to her. Congratulations on being a firewoman. It's great. I think in EMS, we find there's a lot more women on the team. And I think it's easier. I think being a chief has been a little different, because it used to be that this job was called captain. And as it became chief, I saw a little pushback from other areas, and it's over now. You know, it's been years now, so I'm comfortable in this position. My job has not changed one iota from captain to chief. And I think that teams out there, all of the EMS, there's a lot of women on the team that are in good position and leadership positions and are respected in this position. So I don't feel any negativity towards it. Maybe if there is, I guess I'm not looking.
Well, no, you bring up a good, distinguishing point that being a firefighter, a firewoman might be a bit of a different world. And John, who had connected us, who I'm grateful for, thank you, John, did mention to me that he had found some research that did show that there are more women who are EMT volunteers than there are men. And which brings up a whole other conversation. I was doing some research about just volunteerism in general and thinking about who volunteers and who doesn't. And there still is a predominance of women who do volunteer work. Not to say that all EMT services is volunteer, but when you're talking about it being underpaid, sometimes not paid work, you know, it is close to volunteerism, even if there is some pay. So it's an interesting thing for us to think about. And, you know, even just some of the jobs that are historically done by women and them being less funded, midwifery, home care, all these things that are often done by women, they right. aren't as valued.
Right. And I think that just goes across the board and has been that way historically forever, that women are the ones that run to the front lines all the time. They're the nurses generally. They are the ones that are doing the hard work or the gritty work. It's just, I think, in who we are as women. It's in our gene pool. It's who we are. It's how our mind works. We know how to interrupt each other with overlapping support where anybody else would think it's interrupting. We know how to give when everybody else would be like, fingers crossed, I got to walk away. We are made up different. It's just how it is. We are the nurturers. So it would be natural that we're in these nurturing positions, right?
Right. No, I agree. And until we change sort of like the way that men are raised out of this, you know, I think there's a lot of pressure for men to be a certain way, to not show emotion, to not show, you know, sensitivity. And so until we can raise boys to value those things, it will be the women doing that work. I think regardless of whether or not that changes, there should be a financial support for people doing this, whether it's men or women, but it would benefit women most because they're the ones in those roles. So that's right. Why I would like society to step up and do.
Women in EMS and men in EMS, but women in EMS, I mean, we are not paid well at all. And so you can imagine not only these women out there, men also, but women are out there taking care of their children as well as working two and sometimes three jobs to make it happen, because the job that they love doing, which is medical EMS and attending to people and helping people, it's not making it. So they have two EMS jobs. They'll go from one commercial agency to a volunteer agency where they're partially paid. And it goes on and on and on. And it's just, you know, it's not sustainable this way. It's not sustainable. It's not fair. It's not sustainable to human beings to have to live this way. I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that in EMS and at Marbletown First Aid Unit, we, like every other agency, we need support, and we need support from our town. We have dug into our savings so deep. We used to put $30,000 a year into our ambulance fund so that every like 10 years we could buy a new ambulance. Well, because we don't have enough money, we had to scrap our ambulance fund. And we now use that to partially pay our people. And that's the way life is moving. And it really shouldn't be that way. It has to take another turn for the better.
I agree. So what are some things that you do to take care of yourself? Do you have any, you know, things that bring you joy or things that you're consciously doing for yourself that make you feel like you're taking care of yourself. This is my like anti-patriarchal capitalism moment where it's about, you know, making time for you, whatever that looks like.
So I'm a dancer.
Nice.
I've been a dancer my whole life and my mom was a dancer. So I do African dance. I do salsa. I do swing dancing. I do partner dancing. And so that's the glue that keeps me together. And that's the glue that helps me, or that's the ball that helps me fall apart. That's a big part of my center. And in reality, I know that I do the things that I love. There's very little that I do that I don't love. So I love doing this work. I love dancing. I love being outside. I love the dogs. I love doing search and rescue. I love training dogs. I live in a beautiful, beautiful area in the Gunks. I have beautiful land. You know, I am very, very grateful for my life. Very grateful. And I think that that helps me stay in a really good place. My relationship is good, you know. In this time, you know, it's good to have separation sometimes.
It's like, how many children are going to be born now, or divorces will come because of
this? I know everybody's talking about that. There's going to be a baby boom in 9 months. Yeah. And I put my love out to all these women that are pregnant now. Because Teresa, you know, my goodness, they're all wondering. I've gotten 4 calls already about, would you consider helping me if I can't get to my doctor in the city? And I'm like, wow. There's some great midwives here. And I've turned people on to people that I think would be great for them. But a lot of women are really concerned, and rightfully so, about where they can deliver their baby and be safe.
Yeah.
And healthy.
Yeah. It's definitely an unsettling time right now. But I'm, you know, I've seen such a community commitment in Kingston and Ulster County, the county executive doing constant updates, you know, just all the ways that community is coming together, people cheering for you as you're going down the street, you know,
like, that's great.
These are the things that we can do for one another. I wanted to, you know, one of the things that, Rebecca had mentioned was how her son was showing signs of, you know, some of the symptoms of COVID. And I wanted to just acknowledge that I hope he is feeling better. I hope that, you know, and anyone who is suffering in this time and feeling scared about, you know, what's going on, I hope that people can find some place to feel connected and to take care of themselves. And I'm just really grateful, Karen, for the work that you do. I'm grateful for the time that you gave to come on the radio show, and hopefully this just inspires people to kind of dig deep into appreciating all of these people that are around us working hard to take care of us every day.
Yeah. And thank you for having me, and just thank you for being there and doing what you're doing. And also thank you to all these amazing cooperatives are out there that are making masks and making shields and thinking about what we need for our on the front lines for equipment. It really makes us feel so good to know that we can lean on people, like lean on our community and lean on other women. And for me, that is so encouraging and so inspiring. And so thank you for having me. I really appreciate it and love talking with you.
It's been such an honor. That's our show, everyone. Thanks to Ida for holding down the fort, running the engineering board back there. We are going to, I'm going to send you off with a little song that I actually played, I think, during the first episode of this year. It's a song with the message that I like, and it's one from one of my favorite artists, Erica Wennerstrom, and it's Be Good to Yourself.